important.
A sudden dread pooled in Evan's gut. Where did you say the scrapbooking class was? The elevator doors parted on the lobby to reveal a bustling crowd of Castle Heights residents, massed around various craft tables that had been erected for the event. Every head turned to take in Loralee and Evan. Evan made a snapshot count. 17 residents, including HOA President Hugh Walters. They all looked eager for small talk. Evan finally made it into the subterranean parking garage, closed the door behind him, and was about to exhale with relief when he noticed Mia and her 9-year-old son sitting at the bottom of the stairs. Mia shot him a tentative glance. He couldn't blame her for looking hesitant. He'd gone to her last night, ready to leave behind his aliases and untraceable helpline, to see what it might be like to attempt a normal relationship. In the wake of Jack's call, he had left her, and the conversation, hanging. Peter craned his neck, his charcoal eyes staring up. "Hi, Evan Smoke." Evan said, "What's new?" Peter said, "Braces suck."
"Language," Mia said wearily.
"What are you doing down here?" Evan asked.
"Mom's hiding out from the scrapbooking lady."
"That's not true," Mia said.
"Is too. You called her pathologically chipper."
"Well, she is." Mia's hands fluttered, then landed in her chestnut curls, a show of exasperation. "And I just needed a moment away from chipperness." Peter's raspy voice took on a mournful note.
"I wanted to see, is all. Plus, she had a bowl of Hershey's Kisses."
"Okay, okay," Mia said. "Go ahead. I'll be up in a sec." Peter scampered up the stairs, paused before Evan, gave a chimpanzee smile to show off the new hardware.
"Do I have anything stuck in my braces?"
"Yeah," Evan said. "Your teeth." Peter smirked. Then he fist-bumped Evan and shot through the door into the lobby. Mia stood. She did a slow half-turn, stretching her arms, letting them slap to her sides. "That was an odd conversation," she said. "Last night." He came down the stairs. It was hard to be this close to her and not want to move even closer. She was the first person he'd ever met who'd made the notion of another life appealing. He'd had to overcome a lifetime of instinct and training to summon the courage to go to her door last night. It felt like a decade ago. He said, "I'm sorry." "I'm not looking for an apology," she said. "Just an explanation." Evan thought of a digital video camera hurtling around the cabin of a plummeting helicopter. He cleared his throat, a rare nonverbal tell. "I'm afraid I can't give one." She tilted her head.
"You look terrible. Are you okay?"
That image flashed through his mind again. Jack stepping out of the Black Hawk, vanishing into the void. It seemed like a dream remnant, resonant and unreal. "Yes," he said.
"Are we gonna talk about what happened?"
"I can't. Because of whatever things you're into." "Yes." She looked at him more closely. In his childhood, Evan had endured countless hours of training at the hands of psyops experts, training that involved brutal interrogation that lasted hours, sometimes days, to ensure he gave nothing away with his body language or facial expressions. They'd monitored everything down to his blink rate. And yet today emotion had left him loose and vulnerable. He felt as if Mia were looking right through his facade. He stood there, exposed.
"Whatever happened this time," she said, "it hurt you."
Evan locked down his face, held a steady gaze. She gave a concerned nod.
"Be careful."
As he walked past, she caught him around the waist. She hauled him in and hugged him, and he felt himself tense. Her cheek was against his chest, her arms wrapped tight around the small of his back. He breathed her scent. Lemongrass lotion, shampoo, a hint of perfume redolent of rain. He wanted to relax into her. But when he closed his eyes, all he could see was a black hawk spiraling out of control against a backdrop of stars. He tore himself away and headed to his truck. 6. The Brink of Visibility. His tasks for the day completed, Evan sat at his kitchen island before a plate of steaming mahi-mahi, seasoned with thyme from his living wall. The plate was centered precisely between knife and fork. Offset symmetrically beyond the plate were two bowls, one filled with fresh pomegranate seeds, the other with cherry tomatoes, also plucked from the vertical rise of vegetation. His vodka tonight, shaken until bruised and served up, was 666 pure Tasmanian, fermented in barley, single batch distilled in copper pots, and filtered through highest grade activated charcoal. Ice crystals glassed the top. He'd prepared the meal with focus, and he didn't want any of it. He wondered what Mia and Peter were eating in their condo 9 floors below, their colorful home with action figures on the floor, dishes in the sink, messy crayon drawings magneted to the refrigerator. When he'd first visited them, the disorder had made him uncomfortable. But he'd learned to understand it differently, as an affirmation of lives being fully lived. He forced a bite. The flavor was good, and told his body it was hungry. He reminded himself that no matter what emotions were cycling through him, he was a machine bent to a single purpose, and machines required fuel. He ate. When he was done, he scrubbed the plate, dried it, put it away atop a stack of others. It struck him that only the top plate ever got used. He took the vodka over to the big windows stretching along the north wall and stared out at the Los Angeles night. He could see clearly into the building across from his, like peering into a dollhouse. A man emerged from an elevator, scrubbing furiously at his collar with a handkerchief. The fabric came away lipstick red. He folded the handkerchief into his pocket, walked down the hall. Evan watched his wife react happily to the door's opening. They embraced. 3 floors up, a family quartet lay on their stomachs on the living room carpet, playing a board game. Next door to them, a woman sobbed alone in a dark bedroom. An older couple on the top floor practiced ballroom dancing. The woman had a flower in her steel-gray hair. They both smiled the entire time. All that humanity in motion, like observing the inside of an intricate clock, gears and cogs and hidden machinations. Evan could tell the time, but he would never fully grasp the inner workings. His gaze returned to the woman crying in the dark. As he watched her, he felt something inside him twist free, a fresh shoot of grief rising up to match hers. He'd never lacked sympathy. No, that he'd always had in spades. But he'd protected himself from empathy, had withdrawn here to his fortress of solitude, and taken up the drawbridge. He watched the woman sob, and envied her ability to release so powerfully and so well. His release would be paid for in blood. He took a sip of his drink, let it slide across his tongue, cleanse his throat. Hint of dark chocolate, touch of black pepper heat. He dumped out the remaining vodka, then crossed to the Turkish rug near the fireplace, sat cross-legged, and rested his hands gently on his knees. He straightened his vertebrae and veiled his eyes so they were neither open nor closed. He dropped beneath the surface of his skin and focused on his breath, how it moved through him, how it left his body, and what it took with it. He felt the grief and fury inside him, a red-hot mass pulsing in his gut. He observed it, how it crept up his throat, seeking egress. He breathed through it, even as it raged and fought, He breathed until it dissipated, until he dissipated, until he was no longer Orphan X, no longer the Nowhere Man, no longer Evan Smoke. When he opened his eyes some time later, he felt purified. He set aside his grief. He set aside his fury. It was time to get operational. The high-def contact lenses had their own data storage, and as such could be rewound and replayed. Evan watched the footage dispassionately, a bomb investigator searching a blessed site for clues. The POV blinked on, a shuddering view of the Black Hawk's interior. Evan ignored the handcuffed man it was pointed at. Instead, he watched one of the captors slide open the cabin doors to reveal paired slices of night air. It was too dark to pick up any surface bearings. Evan could not determine how high the helo was, though one of the captors had mentioned 16,000 feet. As the wind whipped through and ruffled the hostage's hair, the moon jogged into sight in the corner of the open door. If Evan had a team of NASA astronomers at his disposal, perhaps he could determine the chopper's location based on star position. But all he had in the vault was himself and an aloe vera plant bedded down in a dish filled with cobalt-blue glass pebbles. She was named Vera II, and while she made for excellent company, she lacked the computing power of a team of NASA physicists. He'd already done an extensive news search online and had not been surprised to find that there was no report of a Blackhawks crashing anywhere in the world last night. Van Sciver's non-fingerprints were all over it. If Evan wanted to pick up the trail, he'd have to shine a light in the shadows. He focused on the footage as the freelancers in flight suits positioned themselves around the Blackhawks' cabin. Someone off-screen shouted, "Look into the camera!" The hostage obeyed. Evan searched the captors for identifying tattoos, insignias, but they were geared up from their boots to their necks, only their faces showing. These freelancers loved their apparel. Evan studied their comportment, their builds, their postures. The men not in motion stood like they had two spines. Their boots were straight-laced, the preferred style of hipsters and ex-military. Evan presumed they were not hipsters. Van Sciver liked to use Spec Ops washouts as his guns for hire, dishonorably discharged men who had all the training, but were too brutal or unruly to stay in the service. A voice came from off-camera. "What are your current protocols for contacting Orphan X?" The hostage kept his feet wide for balance and talked to the lens. As the back and forth continued, Evan's eyes picked across the scene for any telling details. A sharpied nickname on a rucksack, a serial number on a gun, a map with a cartoon red X on it. No such luck. They'd done a superb job of sterilizing the visual field. The hostage squared to the lens, gave his line. "And you're dumb enough to think that puts you at an advantage." The ensuing commotion, if viewed with detachment, bordered on comedic. The calmness of the hostage, such contrast to the terror of his captors. As the digital camera flew around the cabin, Evan worked his RFID-covered fingernails, bringing up virtual settings that shifted the footage to slow motion. In the chaos, perhaps something would be revealed. He watched the scene through 5, 6 times, to no avail. Then he changed his focus to a later segment of the footage, when the camera sailed free of the failing helo. He put on a night vision filter, hoping to identify something on the ground, but it was whipping by too fast. Even when he moved to frame by frame, all the flying lens caught were blurs of occasional lights, tracts of what looked like farmland. He was about to give up when he caught a glimpse of a bigger earthbound splotch, less illuminated than the other lights. He reversed and freeze-framed. It was darker because it wasn't, in fact, a light. The night vision wash had picked it up, lightening it to the brink of visibility. He rotated forward one frame, back one frame. That was about all the space he had. He returned to the middle frame,
squinted, instinctively leaned forward.
Of course, the virtual image moved with his head, holding the same projected distance.
Fortunately, Vera too didn't charge.
Evan grabbed the splotch, enlarged it, squinted some more.
A water tower?
With a hatchet cut into it?
It looked like an apple.
No,
a peach. A peach water tower. There was one of those, all right. He'd seen it on a postcard once.
He was already scrambling to free himself of the contact lenses, off with the new tech and in with the old. A Google search brought up the Peachoid, a 1 million gallon water tower in Gaffney, South Carolina. It was located just off Interstate 85 between exits 90 and 92 on the ingeniously named Peachoid Road. It wasn't a big red X on a map, but it was pretty damn close.
7. Two graves.
Evan's wool-rich shirt sported fake buttons hiding magnets that held the front together. The magnets gave way easily in case he needed to go for the holster, clipped to the waistband of his tactical discreet cargo pants. Right now the holster was empty. He wore lightweight original SWAT boots that, with his pant legs down, looked like boring walking shoes. The boots would be a pain to unlace at airport security. In his back pocket, he had one of many passports gorgeously manufactured by a gorgeous counterfeiter, Melinda Trung. The matter was too urgent to wait for a cross-country drive. It was O'Dark 100, and the elevator was empty this early. Thank heaven for small mercies. As the door zippered shut behind Evan, he smelled a trace of lemongrass. On the floor was a pea of balled-up tinfoil. The ghost of a Hershey's Kiss passed. Or maybe he was the ghost, drifting invisibly among the living, following in their wake. The ride down was quiet. He enjoyed it. Evan carved through the whipping desert wind and ducked into the armorer's workshop. Lit like a dungeon, it was off the Vegas Strip and off the beaten path. Evan checked the surveillance camera at the door, verified that it had been unplugged before his arrival, as was the standing agreement. He smelled gun grease and coffee, cigarette smoke and spent powder. He peered through the stacks of weapon crates, across the machines and workbenches that were arrayed according to some logic he'd never been able to decipher. "Tommy?" The sound of rolling wheels on concrete presaged the nine-fingered armorer's appearance. And then there he was, sliding in from stage left in a cocked-back Aeron chair, welder's goggles turning him into some kind of steampunk nightmare. Beneath the biker's mustache, a camel wide crackled, sucked down to within a millimeter of the filter. Tommy Stojak plucked out the cigarette and dropped it into a water-filled red Solo cup, where it sizzled out among countless dead compatriots. Given the ordnance in evidence, a misplaced butt would turn the shop into a 4th of July display. Tommy slid the goggles up and regarded Evan. 15 minutes prior to 15 minutes prior. I could set my watch by you.
You have it?
Of course I have it. What's with the ASAP?
I'm on something. It's highly personal.
Personal? Tommy plucked out his lower lip and dropped in a wedge of Skoal Wintergreen.
Didn't know that word was in your lexicon. You threw in an adverb and everything.
Evan could count the people he trusted on the fingers of Tommy's mutilated hand, with digits to spare. Since the Blackhawks' disintegration, Tommy was one of the few remaining. Even so, Evan and Tommy knew nothing of each other's personal lives. In fact, they knew little of their respective professional lives either. From the occasional dropped tidbit, Evan had put together that Tommy was a world-class sniper and that he did contract training and weapons R&D for government-sanctioned black ops groups that were not as dark a shade of black as the Orphan program. Tommy supplied Evan with his firepower, too, and made each of Evan's pistols from scratch, machining out a solid aluminum forging of a pistol frame that had never been stamped with a serial number. A ghost gun. Then he simply fitted a fire control grip and loaded up the pistol with high-profile straight-eight sights, an extended barrel threaded to receive a suppressor, and an ambidextrous thumb safety, since Evan preferred to shoot southpaw. He ordered all his pistols in matte black, so they could vanish into shadows as readily as he did. As Evan entered the heart of the lair, Tommy used a boot to shove himself away from a crate of rocket-propelled grenades, conveying himself over to a workbench, where he at last creakily found his feet. Laid out on a grease-stained silicone cloth were a laptop and a narrow pistol that looked like one of Evan's 1911s that had gone on a diet. "I skinny-minied this little lady up for you," Tommy said. "What do you think?" Evan picked it up. It fit oddly in his grip. His usual pistol, sliced in half. It was barely wider than the 230-grain Speer gold dot hollow points it fired. He turned it over in his hand and then back. The weight'll take some adjusting to. "That's your way of saying thank you, brother. You're PFM. Pure fucking magic." Evan eyed the sights. "That too." Tommy slung an altered holster across the workbench. "And here's a special sauce high guard kydex to fit it." Evan hefted the weapon a few more times. "To be honest, I wasn't sure how you'd pull it off." "Pull it off?" Tommy's head drew back haughtily. "Boy, I've been calibrating a laser gun for the Navy that can knock drones out of the sky. I've been field-testing self-guided 50-cal sniper rounds for DARPA that change direction in mid-air, fine-tuned a smart scope that doesn't let you shoot a friendly target." He crossed his arms. "I think I can handle smuggling a handgun past a few mouth-breathing TSA agents." He snapped his fingers, pointed to a sticky coffee pot gurgling behind Evan. "Fetch." Evan poured a mug for Tommy, had to wipe his hands on the gun-cleaning cloth. Tommy slurped the coffee across his packed lower lip. Then he lit up another Camel. Evan figured the only reason Tommy didn't smoke them two at a time was that it hadn't occurred to him yet. Tommy pulled three Wilson 8-rounders from his bulging shirt pocket and offered them up. "Test drive it." Evan slotted in the first mag, put on eye and ear pro, and walked to the test firing tube. He ran through all 24 rounds without a hitch. Then he gave a faint nod. He came back over to the workbench. "How's the AFib coming?" Tommy waved him off. "I'm getting extra beats in between my extra beats. I figure I speed shit up enough. I'll go full tilt Iron Man." He jabbed the stub of his missing finger at the arrayed items. "Let me break it down Barney style. Same everything you're used to, but skinnier." "Why skinnier, Chief Stojack, you may ask?" The finger stub circled. "Witness." Tommy took the skinny gun and slid it into the laptop's hard drive slot where some hidden mechanism received it. "All they'll see on the X-ray is the solid block of the hard drive. I had to go 13-inch screen on the laptop to make the specs fit, so they might make you take it out, power it up, all that security kabuki theater bullshit, but you'll be GTG. Obviously you gotta clean the piece so there's no residues that'll ring the cherries in a puff test. As for the laptop, I filled it with bullshit spreadsheets, generic documents, a few stock photos." He picked up the laptop, showed off its slender profile. "High speed, low drag." He made a production of handing it off to Evan, a waiter displaying the Bordeaux. "Go forth and conquer." He gave his gap-toothed smile. "Fair winds and following seas." Evan took the laptop and started for the door. "Hey." Evan turned back. "You're not exactly a barrel of belly laughs generally, but you seem decidedly more somber. This highly personal?" "It's actually highly personal?" "Yes." Tommy studied him, tugging at one end of his horseshoe mustache. The crinkles around his eyes deepened with concern. "You get in a jam. Send up a smoke signal. I'm not too old to cover your six, you know." "I know. But it's something I have to handle alone." Tommy nodded slowly, his gaze not leaving Evan's face.
Remember what Confucius say. Before you embark on a journey of revenge, dig two graves.
Oh, Evan said, I'm gonna dig a lot more than that.
8. Serve with gladness. It had all been for shit. Evan stood in front of his rented Impala on the side of Peachoid Road, staring at the street's namesake, which he had grown to despise. He held the giant fruit monstrosity personally responsible for the stagnation of his pursuit. He didn't know precisely what he was looking for, but some indication that Jack and a 10-ton Blackhawk helicopter had struck the earth in this vicinity would have been a start. Van Sciver's orphans were a conspiracy theorist's wet dream. Not just at killing. They were good at killing, very good. But humans had been killing one another for a very long time. No, this is what they did best. Erased any trace of their actions from the official world everyone else lived in. Nothing for the media, local PD, FBI, even CIA to grab hold of. They moved with the fury of a hurricane and didn't leave a dewdrop in their wake. Evan had driven the frontage and access roads, carved through the checkerboard plots of farmland, housing, and forest surrounding the novelty landmark, searching for that dewdrop to no avail. There was no wreckage, no scorched earth, no Jack's truck abandoned at the side of a road. The flight from Las Vegas, with a layover in Houston, had taken 7 hours and 7 minutes. Driving 53 miles from Charlotte Douglas International had tacked on another 1 hour and 20. A long way to come for a whole lot of nothing. They say that revenge is a dish best served cold, but Evan preferred to serve it piping hot. He took in a deep breath and a lungful of car exhaust. The fourth commandment. Never make it personal. He repeated it over and over in his head, until he almost believed it. Then he got into his Impala and drove off. He took a final loop upslope, winding through thickening forest that coaxed a distant memory of the trees surrounding Jack's farmhouse. He checked his roam zone. Even after a long day, the high-power lithium-ion battery kept the phone's charge nearly full. He wondered briefly what he would do if the next Nowhere Man case rang through. A real Nowhere Man case, as opposed to the personal mission he was on now. After he helped his clients, he asked them to find one, and only one person who needed his help, and to pass on his untraceable number. He had a rule, encoded in the 7th commandment, one mission at a time. For Jack, he was willing to make an exception. He pulled over to get a bottled water at a convenience store. As he headed back to the car, chugging down the water, he caught a chorus of singing voices on the breeze. Only when he turned and saw the open front door of the Baptist church across the parking lot did he realize that it was an actual choir. Drawn by the music, he walked over, climbed the stone steps, and entered. The pews sat empty, but the singers were in place in a choir stand, decked out in royal blue gospel gowns. They were working on an a cappella hymn, practicing beneath a stark wooden cross flooded with light from behind. The choir conductor, an older man, directed from a podium. The voices rose, pure and true. Evan's form in the doorway cut the light, and the director half-turned, his hands still keeping time for the singers. He gave a welcoming nod in the direction of the pews. Evan felt the habitual pull to withdraw. But there was a power in the joined voices that hit him in the spine, made it thrum like a guitar string. He took a seat in the last row and let the hymn wash over him. With the harmony came memories. Waking up in the dormer bedroom in Jack's farmhouse that first sun-drenched morning, walking behind Jack in the forest, filling those boot prints with his own small shoes, the cadence of Jack's voice, how it never rose above a measured pitch during their nightly study sessions. Jack had taught him everything from Alexander the Great's battle tactics to basic phrases in the Indo-Iranian languages to toasting etiquette for Scandinavian countries. Nothing was too trivial. The smallest detail could save Evan's life in the field. Or kill him. He thought about an Arab financier peering through raccoon eyes, wearing a half-moon laceration from Evan's garrote like a necklace. A fat man, bald as a baby and clad only in a towel, staring back at him lifelessly through the steam of a bathhouse, blood drooling from a bullet hole over his left eye. A man slumped over a table in a drab Eastern European kitchen, his face in his soup, the back of his head missing. He thought about what he was going to do to Van Sciver and every one of his men he came across along the way. The choir finished. Before they could disperse, the director cleared his throat to good dramatic effect and said, "Now, when you get back out there with your carpools and your grocery shopping and your punching the clock, you take a little time to think about the works you do and the life you lead. When you're back in this here church one day boxed up in a coffin, that's going to be all that's left to speak for you." With a crinkled hand, he waved them away. "Go on now." The singers filed out, joking and gossiping. A few glanced Evan's way, and he nodded pleasantly. People forget anything that's not a threat, and Evan had no intention of being remembered. He lifted his eyes to the glow behind the altar and wondered at the beliefs men held and what those beliefs drove them to do. In his brief time on the planet, he'd seen so many dead stares, so many visages touched with the gray pallor of death. But he'd never blinded himself to the humanity shining through the cracks of those broken guises. Jack had made sure of that. He'd lodged that paradox in Evan's mind and in his heart. It had saved him, in a manner of speaking. But it came with a price. Evan started to rise when the director turned and caught his eye. The old man limped up the aisle toward him. "Our altos are flat and our tenors are sharp. You'd think it'd even us out some." "It sounded perfect to me," Evan said. "But I've got an untrained ear." "You must." The man sat heavily in the pew next to him, let out a sigh like air groaning through a bellows. "I'll let you get on with your day, sir," Evan said. "Minister." "Minister, thank you for letting me listen. A man doesn't stumble into a church for no reason." Out of deference, Evan didn't take issue with him. The minister sat back, crossed his arms, and gazed at the vaulted ceiling. Evan felt a familiar tug to leave, but realized that for the moment, he had nowhere to be. The minister scratched at his elbow, clearly in no rush. Evan considered the man's words again, decided to rise to the challenge. "Which matters more?" he asked. "Which what matters more?" "At the end, which matters more? The works we've done, or the life we lead?" "Say aye, son. First person. You'd be surprised at how powerful the change is." Evan took a pause. "Which matters more? The works I've done, or the life I lead?" The minister was right. The words felt different in Evan's body and behind his face. "You assume they're different," the minister said. "One's works and one's life. In some cases, like yours, that remains to be seen." The minister gave a frown and nodded profoundly. It took a good measure of dignity to manage a profound nod, but he managed it just fine. "Do you follow the commandments, son?" Evan nearly smiled. "Yes, minister. Every last one." "Then there's your start." Evan held a beat before switching tracks. "I'd imagine that few people are woven into this community as well as you are."
"I'd say you imagine right.
Has there been any word about government folks coming through town? A helicopter, a fire?" The minister arched an eyebrow.
"There has not."
"Suspicious flurry of activity down by the
He hesitated slightly before naming his nemesis.
Petroid?
No. How about alien spaceships cutting crop circles? Evan countenanced the man's watery glare.
Kidding.
What's all this hokum about?
I was supposed to meet a friend at the Peachwater Tower.
Why don't you call him?
Long-lost friend. We'd arranged to meet online.
The minister mused a moment. You sure you got the right one?
A jolt of anticipation straightened Evan up slightly in the pew.
The right friend?
The right Peachoid. Same folks built a smaller one down in Clanton, Alabama.
Evan had not, in fact, been following all the commandments. He'd overlooked the first one. Assume nothing. He rose.
Thank you, Minister. I can't tell you how useful your guidance has been.
I serve with gladness.
Evan shook the proffered sandpaper hand.
As do I.
9. From Beyond the Grave. 5 hours and 38 minutes later, Evan was standing on the side of I-65 between Birmingham and Wetumpka, gazing up at a 500-gallon version of the same eyesore. 27 minutes after that, his headlights picked up Jack's truck parked at the edge of a fire road running between two swaths of cotton that stretched into the darkness, maybe forever. He climbed out of the Impala, unholstered his slender Ares pistol for the first time, and approached the truck tentatively. It was cold enough out to be uncomfortable, but he didn't have any interest in being uncomfortable. He shone a keychain maglite through the windows and took in the damage. Slashed seat cushions, scattered papers from the glove box, holes punched through the headliner. They'd searched as well as he'd expected they would. They'd have been looking for anything that might point them to Evan. His breath fogging the pain, Evan stared at the defaced interior and considered how many years Jack had polished this dashboard, vacuumed the seams, touched up the paint. Anger and sorrow threatened to escape the locked-down corner of his heart, and he took a moment to tamp it back into place. He walked around the truck, searching for booby traps. None were visible. The truck was unlocked. It was 2 decades old, but the hinges didn't so much as creak when the door swung open. Jack's hinges wouldn't dare. Evan sat, where Jack used to sit.
Do you regret it?
What I did to you? He put his hands on the steering wheel. The pebbled vinyl was worn smooth at the 10 and 2, the spots where Jack's hands used to rest.
I wanted to hear your voice.
Out of the corner of his eye, Evan caught a gleam from the molded map pocket on the lower half of the door. He reached down and lifted Jack's keys into the ambient light.
Odd.
Jack never left his keys in the truck. He was a creature of habit. The second commandment had always been his favorite.
How you do anything is how you do everything.
He had drilled it into Evan's cells. There was a likelihood, of course, that Van Sciver's men had taken Jack's keys when they'd grabbed him so they could search his truck. But if that were the case, once they were done, wouldn't they have just tossed the keys back on the seat or dropped them into the cup holder? Placing them in a map pocket low on the door took consideration and a bit of effort.
It's too late for me.
Jack had known he was about to get grabbed.
This is looking to be my 9th life, son. Dollars to donuts, they've got ears on me right now.
And Jack would have controlled the terms. Evan guessed he would have gotten out of the truck under his own power, left it unlocked for the search, placed the keys carefully for Evan to find.
But why?
Sometimes we miss what's important for the fog. But maybe we should give it a go before. You know.
Jack had known he was about to die.
I guess I want to know that I'm forgiven. Evan looked through the dirty windshield. The night swallowed up the land all around. Sitting in the cab of Jack's truck, Evan could just as well have been floating through the black infinity of outer space. "We didn't have time," he told the dashboard. "We didn't have enough time." "I love you, son."
"Copy that," Evan said.
He pondered the darkness, his breath wisping in the November chill. Before he died, Jack had wanted to set things right with Evan. He'd made that much clear. But maybe his words held a double meaning. What if there was something else he was looking to set right? He'd known that Van Sciver was listening. He would have spoken in code. Evan replayed the conversation in his head, snagged on something Jack had said. "Sometimes we miss what's important for the fog." The turn of phrase was decidedly un-Jack. Jack had a down-to-earth, articulate speaking style, the patter of a former station chief. He was not flowery, rarely poetic, and tended to make use of metaphors, only when undercutting them. Evan looked down at the keys in his hand. "Miss what's important for the fog." The realization dropped into his belly, rippling out to his fingertips. He zippered the key into the ignition. The well-maintained engine turned over and purred. Evan sat. He leaned forward so that his mouth would be that much closer to the cooling windshield. And he breathed. A full minute passed. And then another. Fog started creeping in from the edges of the windows. He shifted in the seat, watched the driver's window. As fog crept to the center of the pane, a few streaks remained stubbornly clear. They forged together as the condensation filled in around them, finally starting to resolve in the negative space as letters. In his final minutes, Jack had written a low-tech hidden message for Evan with the tip of his finger. Evan stared at the window, not daring to blink. At last, the effect was complete. Evan's orders standing out in stark relief on the clouded glass. "Get package. 3728 Oak Terrace, number 202, Hillsborough, Oregon." Jack had given him a final mission. 10. A goodly amount of damage. The apartment complex was so sturdy that it bordered on municipal. 10-foot security gate, metal shutters, call box with buzzer. Evan had approached the target slowly, winding in on the address block by block like a boa constricting its prey. Then he'd parked behind the building in the shade of a tree. Hillsborough was lousy with trees, and surveilled. The rented Toyota Corolla reeked eye-wateringly of faux new car smell, courtesy of an overly exuberant car washer. Evan had been watching for 3 hours now, which was a lot of new car smell for a man to take. Traffic ran past steadily. A Tesla Model S flashed by, and more Priuses than he could count. Buses creaked to a stop across the road at intervals approximating 10 minutes, and disgorged various domestic workers and floridly bearded young men. Evan used the reflection off the bus's windows to observe the wide parking lot enfolded in the horseshoe of the 3-story complex. People came and went, and they looked ordinary enough. Then again, so did Evan. The same Hillsborough Home Theater installation van drove by 2 times, a half hour apart. A half hour was an eyebrow-raising interval, though it was plausible that the driver had bid a job, or had completed a small repair and was returning to the shop. Evan didn't like vans. He gave it another hour, but the van didn't reappear. Besides, what idiot would put an exclamation mark on an undercover vehicle? He reapplied a thin layer of superglue to his fingertips. Superglue was less conspicuous than gloves and left him with full tactility. He pressed the fingers of his left hand to the window. They left 5 printless dots. A rickety old Cadillac coasted to the curb across the street from Evan at the rear of the complex. An elderly man emerged, the strains of a Beethoven piano concerto still drifting through the open windows. He began to unload from the trunk various canvases, which he propped against the wall of the building. They featured cubist takes on musical instruments, a deconstructed trumpet, a piano turned inside out. There was a flair to his artwork, an inner life. The canvases kept coming. They lined the base of the building, filled a blanket he spread on the sidewalk, peered from the jaw of the open trunk. The man sat creakily, adjusted his herringbone flat cap, and nodded to the music. Evan listened along with him. It was Concerto No. 3, one of Jack's favorites. He remembered Jack saying that it owed something to Mozart, how all things should honor what preceded them and inspire what is to come. He wondered how he could best honor Jack. The question of inspiration was even thornier. He remembered Jack's message scrawled on the foggy window. He wondered what the hell the package was, and why Jack had hidden it all the way across the continent. Something essential. A long-buried secret from Jack's past that would lead to Van Sciver? Maybe even a torpedo that would sink him. Evan checked his gun. Along with the skinny 1911, he'd smuggled one extra Go to War magazine in the laptop. He'd validated the mag at a range, making sure it dropped clear. That gave him 17 rounds, which was less than he was comfortable with. Then again, he could do a goodly amount of damage with 17 rounds. He heard an echo of Jack's voice. Just don't put all the holes in the same place. He got out of the car. Scanning the traffic, he walked around the east wing of the building, tucking quickly into the horseshoe. At the edge of the parking lot, the call box sprouted from the metal mesh of the security gate. It was a serious gate with a serious double-keyed lock. Another metal gate guarded the stairwell, which was itself caged. Fire hazards, to be sure, but this was a bad section of Hillsborough, whatever that meant, and the folks who lived here cared more about day-to-day safety than about the sliver percentage of a fire-induced stampede. Jack had chosen a good place to hide the package. On the directory, number 202 was blank. Evan scanned the other names. Given the security concerns of the residents, a button-pushing delivery man ruse wouldn't likely get him far. He'd bought a rake pick and a tension wrench at a hardware store and was about to get busy when a guy yammering into a Bluetooth headset clanged out of the stairwell gate. As the man strode up the corridor toward the front, Evan pretended to punch a code into the call box's keypad. "I heard this new ramen place is sick," the guy told his interlocutor and anyone else in the vicinity who might have been interested. "They have like 100 flavors of shochu." He shoved his way out the front gate, ignoring Evan and the rest of the world, and Evan slipped through. In case he had to beat a hasty retreat, he wedged a quarter between the latch and the frame so the gate wouldn't auto-lock. At the stairwell, he finally got to use his pick set. He engaged a second quarter to keep that gate from locking also. A fine 50-cent investment. He crept up to the second floor and down the corridor. Apartment 202 had a peephole. He ducked beneath it, put his ear to the door, heard nothing inside. Though the building was late afternoon quiet, he couldn't risk creeping around the corridor for long. The apartment lock was also double-keyed. With the rake and wrench, he jogged the pins into proper alignment and eased the door silently open. The place was dimly lit and smelled of carpet dust and greasy food. A brief foyer led to a single big studio room. No furniture. He made out a faint scraping sound. Pistol drawn, Evan eased through the foyer, heel to toe, minding the floorboards. More of the studio came into view. A bare mattress, a mound of fast food wrappers, a geometric screensaver casting a striated glow from an open laptop, then an overstuffed rucksack. The scraping grew louder. He eased out of breath, peered around the corner. A girl crouched, facing away, her forehead nearly touching the far wall. She had a mane of dark wavy hair, torn jeans, a form-fitting tank top. It was hard to gauge from behind, but he guessed she was a teenager. She was bent over something, and her shoulders shook slightly. Crying? The closet and bathroom doors were laid open, and there was no furniture for anyone to hide behind. just her. He thought about the double-keyed locks and wondered, was she being held captive? He aimed the Ares at the floor but didn't holster it. Stepping clear of the foyer, he lowered his voice so as not to startle her. Are you okay? She jumped at the sound, then glanced tentatively over her shoulder, her back curled with fear, her expression vulnerable. She looked Hispanic, but he couldn't be sure in the dim light.
Who are you?
She said. I'm not going to hurt you.
Why are you here?
He drew closer slowly, not wanting to scare her. It's a long story.
Can you help me?
He holstered the pistol, but stayed alert. Who put you here?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Her posture suddenly snapped into shape, a bundle of coiled muscle. She pivoted into a vicious leg sweep, leading with the hard edge of her heel, sweeping both of his boots out from under him. As he accelerated into weightlessness, he saw the glint in her eye matched by the glint of the fixed blade combat knife in her right hand. A sharpening stone lay on the carpet, the stone she'd been crouching over, scraping away when he'd walked in. Already she'd rotated, spinning up onto her feet, readying to drive the blade through his sternum. He struck the floor, the wind knocking from his lungs in a single clump, and it occurred to him just how badly he had misjudged the situation. 11. Enemy of my enemy. Evan's first focus was the knife, darting down at him like a shiv stab, all blade, nothing to grab. Laid out on the carpet as if he were a corpse, he swept the bar of his forearm protectively across his chest, hammering the girl's slender wrist and knocking the knife off course just before it broke skin. The tip skimmed his shirt above the ribs, slicing fabric. His second focus was her fist, which she'd cocked and deployed even while her knife hand had still been in motion. He had a split second to admire the technique, knuckles following blade with double-tap timing, before she broke his nose. He rolled his head with the punch, tumbled gracelessly up onto his feet. She grabbed the back of his shirt, but the magnetic buttons gave way. Click, 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 and he spun right out of it. His eyes watered from the blow to the nose, but the escape bought him a much-needed second to blink his way back to some version of clarity. She flung the shirt aside and launched a barrage of kicks. He parried, 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 bruising his forearms and knuckles, holding his attention mostly on the knife. She came at him again, a jailhouse lunge, but now he was ready for it. His hands moved in blurry unison, a bong-sow-lop-sow trap that simultaneously blocked and grabbed her arm. He clenched hard, slid his fist up the length of her forearm, and hit the bump of her wrist with enough force that her fingers released, and the knife shot free. They were nose to nose, her mouth forming an O of perfect shock. He had a wide-open lane to her windpipe. One elbow strike and she'd be over. But Jack's eighth commandment sailed in and tapped the back of his brain. Never kill a kid. He barreled her over and pinned her with a cross-face cradle, a grappling move that left her locked up, her knees smashed to her cheek, arms flailing uselessly to the sides.
"Get off me!" she shouted. "I will kill you! I will fucking—"
He pressed his forehead to her temple, immobilizing her head and shielding his eyes. "Breathe," he said. She inhaled sharply. "Again." She obeyed. "Where is the package?" he asked.
"What?
What did you do with the package?"
"The hell are you talking about?"
"You saw the message. You beat me here."
"Can you get your knee out of my ribs?"
Evan eased off the pressure. "What did you do with it?" She gave no answer. Each breath rasped through her contorted throat. Blood was trickling from Evan's nose, tickling his cheek. "I'm gonna let you go, and we're gonna try this again, okay?" Her answer came strained.
"Okay."
"I'd prefer not to have to kill you."
"I'd like to say the same, but I haven't decided yet."
He released her, and they stood. They kept their palms raised, halfway to an open-hand guard. She drew in deep lungfuls, her cheeks flushed. She was expertly trained, but still green. He got his first clear look at her. Her hair fell to her shoulders, thick and dark and lush. The right side had been shaved short, but it was mostly hidden by the tumbling length of her locks, a surprisingly subtle effect. She was lean and fit, her deltoids pronounced enough to show notches in the muscle. "I'm going to put my shirt back on," he said. "If you come at me, it won't go well for you." Keeping his gaze on her, he backed up and put on his shirt. Next to the rucksack, a ragged flannel rested on the carpet. He tossed it to her. She tugged it on. Keeping a bit of distance, they stared at each other. A wisp of agitated piano reached them from outside, the concerto hitting the third movement. "Let's cut to it," Evan said. "I see how you move. I know you're an orphan. I know who sent you."
"You don't know anything."
"What's the package?" She answered him with a glare. He risked a fleeting look at her rucksack. "Is it in there?"
"No."
He crouched over the rucksack. "Don't touch my stuff." He rooted around in it, sneaking quick glances down. Clothes, a few toiletries, a shoebox filled with what looked like personal letters. "Put those down." "Is there some kind of code in these papers?"
"No."
He armed blood off his lower lip. "Is the package something on the laptop?"
"No."
"If you're lying, I can hack into it." Her mouth firmed into something more aggressive than a smirk. "Good luck." As he started to reach for the laptop, it suddenly alerted with a ping, the screensaver vanishing. 4 surveillance feeds came up, tiling the screen. It took a moment for Evan to register that they were streaming different angles of the outside of the apartment complex. The bottom left feed showed 2 SUVs blocking the horseshoe of the parking lot. Teams of geared-up operators charged for the front gate.
"Your backup's here," the girl said.
"What, you couldn't handle me yourself?" Her voice stayed tough, but her chest heaved with the words. She was scared, and this time he knew she wasn't faking it. Evan stared at the screen. The operators displayed a similar military precision to that of the men in the Black Hawk. Evan counted 6 of them. 17 rounds. 6 men. "Just don't put all the holes in the same place." On screen, the lead operator kicked the front gate and it clanged open. Evan heard it in stereo, registered the vibration in the floor. He and the girl watched as the men poured into the ground floor corridor. He said, "They're not with me." His eyes met the girl's, and he saw that she believed him. Her voice was hammered flat with dread.
"You left the gates unlocked behind you."
Clang! The stairwell gate flew open, courtesy of Evan's ill-spent 25 cents. The men throttled up the stairwell. The girl's eyes darted from the screen back to Evan. "Enemy of my enemy," he said. She gave a nod. He drew his Ares. "Get behind me. Pick up your knife." The girl moved, but not for the knife. She shot over to the mattress and lifted it, revealing a hatch cut through the floor. She looked at him, eyes wild, hair swinging.
"My stuff," she said. "Get my stuff."
The clamor of the men reached the second floor, spilled onto the corridor. Evan snapped the laptop shut, rammed it into the rucksack, tossed the combat knife in after. She slipped through the hatch and disappeared. The mattress fell back into place, covering the hole. He didn't hear her land. He sprinted across the room. As he yanked up the edge of the mattress, he heard the front door smash in. Snatching the rucksack behind him, he shoulder-rolled beneath the mattress, free-falling. A thump announced the ceiling of the hatch above. He rotated to break his fall, but a soft landing caught him off guard. His boots struck another mattress, positioned on the ground floor directly beneath the one above. He tumbled off the side onto the carpet. He looked up. The girl was waiting. She wrenched the rucksack from his grip, pistoned her leg in a heel stomp directed at his throat. He caught her foot in both hands and twisted hard, flinging her aside. She bounced up off the floor like a cat, shot across the room, flung open the window. As she leapt through, he grabbed a strap of the rucksack, halting her momentum. She jerked back and banged against the outside wall, one arm bent over the sill. She wouldn't let go of the rucksack. They were both off balance, caught in a ridiculous tug-of-war across a windowsill. Boots drummed the floor above. It was only a matter of time before one of the men looked under the mattress. Evan dove through the window, collecting both the rucksack and the girl in a bear-hug embrace. They sailed past the elderly artist, their fall cushioned by the blanket covered with his paintings. The Cadillac's radio blared away, the C major coda galloping along in presto. Evan hopped to his feet, broken frames falling away, the cubist pieces now cubist in three dimensions.